You're listening to The Jackie Daily Show. Find me online at jackiedaily.com. That's Jackie with no E. Daily like every day. And from there on the website, you can link over to subscribe to the podcast for free at your favorite podcasting outlet. Take your pick. Could be theblaze.com. Could be iHeartRadio. Could be Spotify. My new favorite. Take your pick. It's all free. And you'll be notified every time a new podcast posts, which is separate from this show, which airs on The Blaze weekly, every Sunday morning before church, and in the Permian Basin, Midland, Odessa, etc., in the 10 counties surrounding KWEL 107.1 FM, 1070 AM. And also from the website at jackiedaily.com, you can follow me on the X at Jackie Daily Host, on Facebook and on Instagram, Jackie Daily, or Truth Social, or LinkedIn, in fact, or Rumble, or YouTube. I have some new videos coming out. I think you'll enjoy them. And not just videos that I create, but where I am guests on other shows. I've got the Wayne Christian podcast, Wayne's World, going up. Also the Sweet Tea podcast, the Blue Bonnet podcast, Texas Public Policy Foundation, and a few other in the works, actually. Thank you to the Houston Magic Circle Women's Group. I just came back from Houston. I want to thank Buckley, Alicia, Bridget, and all the ladies there in Houston. I had such a good time. I need to get out more, really. I need to travel more. It was a lot of fun. And from my remarks there about how to keep the U.S. energy dominant and how to keep that Texas grid up and running, which is a challenge. Would you believe this? There's not enough power in Texas. It's true. Not because we're not sitting on an ocean of natural gas, but because of bad decisions in Austin. I explained that. I was invited back for a couple of other upcoming Houston appearances. Those are not set in stone yet, but I'll let you know when we figure those out. But it's coming up. Also coming up, if you happen to be in Dallas or if you're traveling here this month for the EarthX Conference, the EarthX Conference hosted by my friend Trammell Crow, it has turned into a massive, huge gathering every year of environmentalists in Dallas, Texas. And I'm very excited because I've been invited to be on two panels this year at EarthX. Environmentalist that I am. Green queen that I am. First of all, I'll be addressing a lot of family offices here in Dallas and elsewhere. Family offices is something I didn't know anything about until I moved to Dallas. There must be over 100 of them here. These are literally very wealthy families. Often oil and gas families, but not always. And they invest. That's all they do, is invest and manage wealth. I'm going to talk to them about why they should be proud and supportive of U.S. oil and gas, because why? It's environmentally safe. We probably produce energy more cleanly in this country than anywhere else. And if you think that the activists should shut down energy production here at home, and if they somehow succeed, you should understand that we're just going to get it from somewhere else that doesn't have any environmental standards, likely. There are dozens and dozens and dozens of countries that produce oil and gas, and most of them are petrostate dictatorships that answer to no one but themselves, and they do what they want. If you want clean energy, you want American energy. So I'm going to talk about that on the 25th, I believe. On the 26th, I will be on a panel talking all about wind turbines and endangered species, specifically raptors. I think I told you, a member of my household funded a study that examined hundreds of other studies that have looked at this issue of, for example, how badly do wind turbines decimate the American bald eagle population or the peregrine falcon population or the golden eagle, whatever. There are lots of bat species. In these studies, what you find is that most of them don't take a baseline. In other words, what was the population before the wind farm went in? Therefore, they're meaningless. And this is so true of so much research. The methodology is so fatally flawed that you can't pull anything. You can't learn anything from a study that doesn't do a proper baseline. And it's an outrage. And this study proved that across hundreds of studies, which probably produced thousands of headlines. The headlines are what it's all about. That's what you're really buying. Because, you know, we learned from an article that 60% of Generation X admits they only read headlines. They don't read content, which drives me crazy. I can't imagine a life without reading. I read incessantly all day long. And I mean, I don't care what it is. If I'm standing in line, it's whatever's on the tabloids. If I'm standing at my cupboard, it's whatever's on the cereal box. I can't not read. I don't know how other people cannot read. But apparently, they're very good at it. They only read headlines. And so these studies produce these false headlines. Probably something like, you know, wind turbines are safe for endangered species, or wind turbines and bald eagles, the lion laying down with the dove, or whatever it is. No, the eagle flies with the dove. The lion lays down with the lamb. Is it the lamb? This is embarrassing. I've forgotten the biblical reference. You know the thing. You know the thing. Anyway, EarthX coming up. By the way, on that second panel, I'm tag teaming with my other half, Doug Deason. Also, I have what's the equivalent of a top secret event in the civilian world coming up. I can barely tell you about this one. I'm going to have dinner at the home of one of the top 50 wealthiest people on Earth. I can't tell you who just yet. What I will tell you is that this person, I think, is not a fan of the Jackie Daly Show. I also think, and I actually have more evidence for this, this person is not a fan of Jackie, personally, outside of the Jackie Daly Show. And I've got the proof. All the same, I've been invited to dinner, which is very interesting. I actually think it must have been a mistake. An accident. I don't know how I got on the list. Who knows? I might be ejected when I show up at the front doormat. But I'm going. And we will see if I can win this person over, along with maybe the spouse. And so, I wish I could tell you exactly who this is. But I'm going to wait until after the event. Because you know why? I meet with a lot of people who are high profile, who are in the news, who are influential. And as a general rule, I don't disclose most of that publicly. I try to do a really good job of keeping confidences, not burning sources. I don't want people to see me and run the other direction saying, there's the woman who will parrot whatever I say on a loudspeaker through the microphone. I don't want to be that person. You have to be very careful when you have a show that you watch what you say. And so, I shall. I will not tell you which member of the top 50 wealthiest people on Earth I will be having dinner with at their home. I could give you another hint. Should I? Anyway, I won't do it. Will I? What else could I tell you? I don't know. I'll tell you that I had to postpone a catfishing trip with the family to put this on the calendar. So it's big time. You know what? For me, it's all about influence, okay? And it doesn't matter if the person likes me or not. I have this amazing gift, this amazing ability to like people who don't like me back. I've been able to do that all of my life. And sometimes I win them over. So anyway, let's see. I really, really hope that I'm able to tell you all about it when I get back. This will be when? This is going to happen in the middle of April. So it'll be a couple of shows from now, at least, maybe three before I can share anything. Anyway, as I've told you before, I strongly encourage you to force audiences and conversations with people who don't think like you. I feel like the country is becoming so divided and so polarized, and that's because the certain members of the elites and media want that. It's easier to win elections when you can divide people, because then guess what? You only have to win over the bigger half, right? So you get, 60% of the population believes this, 40% believes that, voila. You put your finger in the air, you take the 60% position, you win. It's a lot easier to win a divided country. Some people seek to divide. A house divided cannot stand. Division. It is a biblical topic. Look this up. So we have thousands of years of history with this phenomenon. And the most powerful divisions, as you know, are race or sex, sometimes religion. Don't let it happen. Please, go to people who don't think like you and politely and respectfully attempt to charm them first with your glowing personality, and have them like you and figure out that you care. No one cares how much you know till they know how much you care. Force the conversation. This is how we win. This is how we really pull the rug out from under the dividers and the polarizers and the hate stokers. This is how you win. Human relationships are very powerful. Make sure you have them with people who don't think like you. All right, I have to get a break. You're listening to The Jackie Daily Show. You're listening to The Jackie Daily Show. Find me online at jackiedaily.com, on the X as Jackie Daily Host, and on Instagram. I forgot to tell you that the week before last, I went to the Billy Joel concert where Stevie Nicks opened for him. It was awesome. I am the biggest Billy Joel fan. I mean, I played a lot of his songs at my wedding. That's how much. So it was like, truly, the piano sounded like a carnival, just like he said. I was so happy. I could not hear that music loudly enough, you know? Do you ever have that experience where you just can't get it loud enough? That's how I felt. That was at Dallas's AT&T Stadium, home of the Cowboys. It was so good. And as I was listening, it occurred to me, when he played Allentown, it kind of reminded me of several things I had said recently on the show. So I want to play just the very opening of Allentown so you know exactly what I'm talking about. This is the 1982 second single from The Nylon Curtain. Well, we're living here in Allentown. Okay. That's enough. Thank you. Okay, so this is considered to be a blue-collar anthem, and I love this song. I'm from the Rust Belt of Ohio. I'm from the steel mills, coal mines, railroading towns of Ohio. So I'm part of this. He's writing about Bethlehem Steel, which was the second largest producer of steel, and how the world has changed, and we're losing all these manufacturing jobs. Everyone's standing in line. And for a guy who's not a working class guy, I don't think, he captured it really well. I mean, there's nothing in this song that is a dead giveaway that he isn't actually from the American working class. I feel like he's got all the phraseology that I grew up with. He also did a very good job in his song about Vietnam. Remember, we said we'd all go down together. He also wrote that one as if he were actually there. Some people have a real talent for capturing the moment, but I doubt that he appreciated in that song several themes that are like Jackie Daly Show big themes. Number one, he talks about our fathers fought the Second World War. And then he talks about no one taught us what was real, iron and coke, chromium and steel. And I doubt that he connected the two ideas, But I keep telling you that fossil fuels won World War II. This is the perfect quintessential example of exactly what I'm talking about. You know the obvious point, which I've been driving home constantly, which is that the U.S. produced about 70 to 80% of the Allied forces' fuel in World War I and II. And I believe if the Green Agenda actually ever happened, it won't, the way they say it will. If it ever did, we couldn't do that in World War III. And our enemies know it. It concerns me a lot. But what's also overlooked is, I'm sure people listening in Pennsylvania or Southern Ohio, where I'm from, would say, yeah, you keep saying that fossil fuels won the war. What about American steel? Okay? What about Bethlehem steel? What about U.S. steel, which just got sold to Japan, or a Japanese group, as you know? Okay. Conceded the point. I will concede the point. There's a very famous Supreme Court case about the president moving to nationalize the steel industry in the world wars. It was that constitutional. These are private steel industries, obviously strategic commodity. I have several thoughts about this. First of all, to give you an idea of how important steel was, because I'll concede the point right now. Before we entered World War II, 1941, the U.S. was producing 41 million automobiles a year. 41 million. No, I'm sorry. 1941, excuse me, 3 million. Sorry. 1941, right before the war, 3 million vehicles a year. During the war years, we only produced 139 vehicles. I found this from a credible source that does steel industry history. Can you imagine? It's because all of the scrap metal was used to produce weapons. Everything from ships to aircraft to tanks to vehicles, weapons. There was a campaign by the government to donate your scrap metal, and I mean all of it, all the way down to the tin in your toothpaste tube or shave cream tube. That's how much we needed metal. And you can only make steel with what? Carbon. Coal. Specifically. Primarily. Historically. There are new ways, of course, to make steel. They're more green and less carbon intensive, but it remains true. Steel making is one of the most carbon intensive industries in the world. Now notice, obviously, you got to have diesel. You got to have fuel to win a war. I've told you all about this. Hitler tried to push into Baku, Azerbaijan, to take those oil fields. We might have had a different outcome if he had been successful. That's how big a deal this is. And so, in addition to the fuel, you need steel. You need coal to make steel. What I'm saying is, when people are taking aim at carbon, at oil, gas, and coal, they're taking aim at our ability to defend ourselves. They're taking aim at our ability to equip our allies in a war. I'll tell you, whoever controls the oil, gas, and coal can win the world war, the next one. If you don't control it, you're in big trouble. There's a whole history that no one wants you to remember, if they can help it, about how the British got into Iran just after 1900. And from that came British Petroleum, or BP. And then we worked to lock up the Arab states, specifically Saudi Arabia. And that is a lot of our history in the 20th century. It's a game changer. It's a total game changer. I cannot emphasize this enough. I don't think that Billy Joel connected the war, chromie, coke, steel, iron, all together. I'm sure, yeah, he didn't title the song Fossil Fuels Won the War or Bethlehem Steel Won the War. But that really is the case. And those people who worked in those industries are very proud of that. This is still known in the Rust Belt. People who are blue-collar America want to be proud. They want to be proud of what they were, what their, you know, very often what their fathers were, what their grandfathers were. It is very common to find multi-generational existence of a family in steel or in coal mining or whatever. I mean, in fact, to the point that it drove me crazy in college, how many times did I hear a young man say, Dad was a coal miner, Grandpa was a coal miner, Great-grandpa was a coal miner, and I'm going to be a coal miner. And I'm like, you know what? You might or you might not. The way things are going, you know, politically, I wouldn't be so sure. And I don't say that with any delight or glee. I'm from there. It's totally part of my family history. My great-great-grandpa died in a coal mining accident, maybe 20 minutes from my home. My great-great-uncle was in that accident, had a broken back, but survived it. So believe me, it's part of the DNA. But part of this business of losing manufacturing, which is what the song is focused on, is due to a couple of things. You know, we're competing with cheap labor around the world. That's certainly part of it, right? If you can go to, essentially, a underdeveloped country and exploit cheap labor, that's really hard for the union guys to compete with. But also, and this is so important, it's about cheap energy. So when the fracking revolution came on and natural gas just flooded the world market, bringing down the price, suddenly the United States again became competitive with other countries because other countries had high energy costs, but we had low energy costs. If you're a manufacturer, your people and your energy are often two of your biggest costs. So we became competitive again, and a lot of jobs reshored. That's good news. And this really all came to the fore. People didn't really, maybe they wouldn't describe it the way I'm describing it, but they could feel it in the election of 2016. There was a feeling that this guy Trump actually cared about American industry. Those things which made us dominant, whether it was steel or oil or labor or whatever. And so it's really interesting to watch because most of these people who show this impulse for American industry, they're not economics majors. They just feel it. You know what? It's been a steady drumbeat that's getting stronger and stronger. The globalism is not, does not make everyone winners, especially not the people who are winning 50 years ago. Whether it's with their job or it's the value of a dollar, the value of a dollar, you know, and you could buy, you know, 6 Big Macs with the money it would take to buy one today. This stuff, the silent killer of your wealth and financial well-being, inflation, also because of bad policy, hurting people like the people in Allentown. But let me give you the takeaway, the bottom line. You have to emit a lot of carbon to win a war. Don't forget that. Think about it in terms of America. Think about it in terms of our adversaries. How about Russia? They are a petrostate. They live and die by the price of oil and gas. So does Saudi Arabia. So do most of OPEC. Who are we concerned about? What countries concern us? Do they have access to abundant oil and gas and coal? If they do, we might have a problem. If they don't, all they have is asymmetric weapons. Things like attacking the grid, things like bioweapons, like pandemics, dirty bombs, things like this. That's bad enough. Hacking, sabotage, I don't know, bridges, let's say. Can you hack a boat that would hit the main support of a bridge? I don't think it's possible. Who's capable of that? I can think of a few people. We're going to break. You're listening to The Jackie Daly Show. Okay. Jeff Fisher of Chewing the Fat with Jeff Fisher. Let's talk about it. So RFK Jr. selects Ms. Nicole Shanahan. She appears to be in her 30s as his running mate. But importantly, she's loaded. You might say, what is a 38-year-old lawyer who's barely practiced. She's an entrepreneur. She's a philanthropist. She looks very young. Very, very young.
Her speech did not do her any good. In her speech to say that she was going to be vice president with RFK a few days ago, did not do her any good.
Why not?
Because she did not sound like vice presidential or presidential timber.
She wasn't up to Kamala Harris's standards.
Well, I don't know if she was that bad.
Now look, let me be crystal clear, okay? I don't tell anyone who to vote for ever. I got a lot of friends who are very big on RFK Jr. My job is to point out who this guy really is and has been. He wrote, I'm going to tell you for the umpteenth time.
I know.
He wrote an article in 2014 called Jailing Climate Deniers, which now is taken down, but it is preserved for you by Reason, the libertarian publication. Sometimes libertarians come through with the win, with the score. And essentially, people like me, like this show, because of what I say on this show, he would have me destroyed corporately. I would not be able to speak. This show would not be permitted to exist.
You're not the only one at this network.
No,
that's
right.
He wanted to throw in jail and be done with.
When he denied it, he walked it back very quickly. Even though it's titled Jailing Climate Deniers, he was like, whoa. I didn't mean throwing people like Jackie in a cage. What I meant was that I just want to do corporate death. For, you know, Exxon and anyone who supports fossil fuels, that is all. Okay, so I'm not telling you how to vote, people. I know he's charming. You know what? I follow RFK Jr. very, very closely on Twitter because he writes some amazing stuff now that he's trying to wreck a candidate's campaign on the campaign trail, one of the two major, or maybe, who knows, maybe both of them. He has some
good
tech
for. With this pick, you'd think that he's trying to destroy President Biden. More than
I
he
agree.
Is Donald Trump.
I agree, but here's the thing. He's the dominant voice. And his Twitter account right now basically is a cheap imitation of the Trump account. Damn. I mean, my friends who are Trumpian are defecting over to RFK Jr. because they're believing all this. I said, hey.
No, they can't
please,
do that.
I want you to remember the free speech. His free speech policy is outright tyrannical. I wouldn't exist. And let's not forget he led the fracking ban in New York alongside Governor Cuomo.
Yep.
So that's who he is. That's who you get. VPs don't normally mean anything, but Politico.
I mean, this is such a, I don't understand the pick. All right. So if I don't understand the pick. First of all, I'd like to say that, good for her. She came from nothing.
Yeah.
And
right.
Figured out that she can make herself fall in love with a rich guy and have a kid and get divorced and make a bunch of money. And now she's a philanthropist.
And she only...
I'm not opposed to that.
She was married for 4 years to Sergey Brin.
Look, if Brin is looking for another spouse, I'm here for him.
You ready to step in? This is Google co-founder Sergey Brin. And she was accused of having an affair with Elon Musk, which he vehemently denies.
Well, they both denied that.
So I don't know. Maybe it's not true.
Yeah,
but
whatever.
The point is...
Whatever.
She's very strange. Okay, is investing in like reproductive fertility extension, which is interesting. I find that to be a very interesting VP pick. Like that's her issue or one of them. That's her deal.
After
practices
his list,
yoga.
Yeah. After his list of, Jesse Ventura, Aaron Rodgers,
Jesse Ventura,
Mike Rowe, after that list, and you think, okay, well, those are strange, but they are actually people that the world knows and would have know where they're coming from and know what they stand for and are able to enunciate what they believe in, whether you agree with it or not. Then to pick this person, it's almost like he's not a serious candidate.
It's very interesting. What he's trying to do is reassure his hard left voters that would be inclined to vote for him at all, that he is a hard leftist. This woman is pretty left.
Yes, no question.
If you look through the Politico laid out like 55 things you need to know about Ms. Shanahan, she is grew up on welfare.
Yeah, she started with nothing.
The daughter of a Chinese immigrant. Mother came from a communist country. I don't know if that had an influence or not. single parent household, dad was checked out. She's on food stamps.
Yeah, I mean, they lived and survived thanks to government help for many, many years.
Yes. And so, and you know, look, she was born into it. I'm not criticizing the lady for that. I, too, came from beneath the poverty line in Appalachia, although both my parents worked. She bused tables at a local burger restaurant at age 12. Then she became a hostess, and she had tips. You know what? Me, too. I worked as a teenager. I worked for tips at one time. I appreciate all that. I appreciate all that. However, comma. And then she actually became a lawyer. Me, too. I appreciate all this. Great. She married a rich guy. I don't know anything about that. But I'm just saying, she came out very differently on the environmental issues, strangely. She's very, very concerned about climate change.
Uh-huh.
Which makes her pretty mainstream for the San Francisco Bay Area.
Yeah.
She shares that with RFK Jr.
That's for sure.
Yeah. And so, you know, she's able to say things that he can't say. Okay, this is part of the value of the VP, just as, you know, just to say Trump would pick a Pence, who is a foil, right? So Pence is not Trumpian. Pence is like quintessential Midwestern evangelical, straight-laced,
yes,
soft-spoken guy. He's meant to reassure a certain segment of the Trump base.
And that worked for a while.
It did work. And it might work again. I actually would look for maybe for Trump to pick someone like Ben Carson, actually. He is a surgeon, otherwise very soft-spoken, evangelical, level-headed guy, not bombastic at all, maybe. So I think that that's part of what you're seeing here is, you know, RFK has like ran hard to the center or even the right. Even the right, I would say. And this lady has her moments. She's pretty unapologetically on board with crisis mode for environmental policies.
Yeah.
And so, you know, she's going to say for him what he wishes he could still say, but he can't. He did tweet that he's still anti-fracking. I don't think he understands how disastrous that is in states like Pennsylvania, Ohio.
There's plenty of states that it costs huge not to be fracking.
There are 36 states total that produce fossil fuels. Some of them are coal states, predominantly, as opposed to oil and gas. But whatever. It's like, I really don't think that Northeastern liberals from Martha's Vineyard fully appreciate how that plays across the country. I feel like actually my position is the majority position, slightly.
Well, no question. And look, they want to have their cake and eat it too, right? They want to be able to use social media and the internet and have AI and have these data tech centers built around the country that do nothing but drain energy and use power. But they want to create an environment that doesn't allow you to have energy or power. How's that going to work out?
That is a super strong point, and you did not cheat and look at my stack of stuff today. I actually have a headline here from David Blackman today in Energy. AI is a power hog.
Yeah, I mean,
hog. It says the trouble
Everything is.
Trough is getting empty, as is Bitcoin. And by the way, I have a Bitcoin guy booked for the show, Lee Bratcher, coming up in 2 weeks. There's a massive Bitcoin farm, whatever in the heck that is, but I'm going to find out. I've got a tour coming up.
Okay.
And Lee's going to take me. And so he's going to come on and tell us why it's so terrific. Maybe it is. But you should know.
But they're power draining.
It is. I don't understand this fully. We're going to find out. I'll ask him all the right questions. It is a massive power drain.
And look, they all look. We've talked about it on this show forever. But the unforeseen circumstances with electric vehicles in this country is now starting to show up, right? I mean, we don't have the natural resources. We have to, that hurts the land to get them, and it also, you know, creates other issues. They're too heavy. We don't know what to do with the batteries. And speaking of being too heavy, which means that our infrastructure isn't built to withstand the weight of the electric vehicle, including parking garages, including
guardrails
on the interstate, including just the interstate itself.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I mean, it's just One would say that it would even maybe harm bridges, but that's just me. I don't know what I'm talking about.
Where would you get the idea to talk about a bridge? Listen, I'm telling you that I saw an article today on Real Clear Energy that a guy posits that the EV issue could actually, the electric vehicle issue, could actually decide the election, because in Michigan and Wisconsin, there's this huge workforce, right? And yeah, it would require that we cut the American auto workers' workforce by about 30%.
Well, they're going to have to, and they already are, right? I mean, they just signed the new deal. If we want to get into it, we can. But they just signed their new union deal that everybody's so happy about, just like they're doing in California, saying, yeah, everybody can make $20 an hour, and everybody working for General Motors and Ford can make $150,000 a year and get all the benefits they want. Oh, by the way, that's not all of you, though, because we're firing at least 3/4 of you to be able to pay for the rest of it. It's just amazing. So they, I mean, absolutely, it costs energy. And you saw where, I mean, the huge solar panel farm gets destroyed in Texas because of weather. It's just unbelievable. We cannot survive without fossil fuels, without energy. And I mean, that's what we talk about on this show all the time. But
now, Jeffy, there you go, blaming the solar farm. It's our fault.
Oh, yeah, I'm sorry.
For not properly winterizing and weatherizing the solar panels, just like we didn't properly weatherize those blades on the wind turbines that froze. We were supposed to prevent ice from falling onto you.
I know.
As something you decide, you know, the blades on the big ones are longer than a football field.
Oh, yeah, they're huge. I mean, we've seen them moved around. I see them all the time here in Texas and on the trains and on semis on the roads being transported.
They should never be allowed on the road. Imagine a truck. So it's just the length of the truck, yep, plus the load being longer than a football field.
Yeah, they've got a sign on the back of it. What's your problem?
They sure do. They sure do. If you're a Texan, you've seen this, because we are the capital here in the wind corridor. You've definitely seen it, especially out in West Texas, middle of nowhere. They're all over the place.
And those are recyclable too, right?
No, I'm sorry.
No, they're not.
And they're, you know, they're one of, they made of fiberglass and other, you know, fossil fuel derived products.
We don't know how long they'll last. We're just burying them, I believe. That's my theory, that we recycle them though and use them to build a wall on the border, on the southern border.
I've heard far worse, you know, theories and plans.
Use the blades, turn them, every other one upside down, put them in the ground. That's our wall.
I've heard worse plans, right? Because right now we're using the train cars.
The storage containers. Yeah,
yeah. So, and people live in them. Actually, they become, you know, little villages, little homes. That's right. Anyway, all right. I know we're all out of time.
We covered a lot of ground there, but we began with RFK's vice presidential pick, and it's a strange, strange pick. And
but she's got a lot of cash, Jeffy.
Yeah, but there's a lot of people with a lot of cash.
He's got to buy access to the ballot on state by state, and they're not treating him right. They're not treating him right. But you know what? She was a donor, and so he got to. You know, I'll tell you how this works. Okay. You give $10,000, just like that BlackRock guy got caught on James O'Keefe's video.
Yeah.
$10,000, you can buy a senator, is what he said. Presidential candidates, probably a little more, but you're buying the ability to speak to them and communicate with them.
Yeah.
And at a minimum. And so he would definitely have just met this woman. And if she said, hey, excuse me, I just divorced Sergey Brin. He's worth $148 billion. And I'm willing to kick in a little bit to help you get on the ballot. If you put me on too, who knows what they talked about. But I'm telling you, that's why I believe he picked her. She's got mega bucks. Yeah. We don't know what the settlement was in the divorce. We don't know. But come on, he was worth $148 billion.
Oh, yeah.
She got something.
And she's got a child.
I mean, and you know, if she's got $500 million, that goes a long way.
Sure does.
To get you on a few states' ballots. So that's why it makes sense.
Yeah.
It's okay. She's 38 and you know, she might be a fine lady. I don't know. But she has some really wrecked ideas about the green agenda. But hey, his people are going to like it. She will pull votes from Biden if she pulls from anywhere.
Sergey, email me, chewingthefat@theblaze.com. chewingthefat@theblaze.com. I'm here for you.
I'm not here for you, Sergey. He's probably all right. All right, you're listening to The Jackie Daly Show. We'll take a break. You're listening to The Jackie Daly Show. Okay, I found this really interesting article by three experts. Experts. I have their bios right here. Apparently, they are all at the U.S. Naval Postgraduate School. They have a book called Operational Energy. It's all about the importance of oil and gas and other logistics in wartime. Totally up my alley. Okay. So, I see this article commenting on this. This is Real Clear Energy. Washington denies a bedrock of warfighting. And interesting, fascinating. It says the Biden administration recently pressed Ukraine to halt attacks on Russian oil refineries. Right. Okay. Ukrainian strikes on refineries and tankers have contributed to a rise in the global oil price. That's exactly right. Especially diesel. Diesel is the fuel of choice in a theater of war. Okay, I saw this happen, and I said to some friends of mine, all that surprises me is how long this took. I'm shocked that Ukraine didn't hit the refineries and the tankers earlier. Russia is a petrostate, as I remind you. They rely on oil and gas for the majority of their budget and revenues, and they use it to fight a war. You can't fight a war without it. Okay. I find it very interesting that that the commentary here is this. The last thing that Biden administration wants in an election year is higher fuel prices and the associated inflation in other goods and services. That's correct. It says, but in acting to halt rising oil prices, Washington is undermining the Ukrainian war effort. So, okay, these people think it's bad for Ukraine to hit these strategic energy targets. It says denying energy supplies to the adversary in war has long been a bedrock of military strategy. Yes. Washington's policy toward adversary fuel supplies is likely to lengthen the war as well as the Gaza war. Okay, so scathing criticism of Washington for telling Ukraine to stop attacking Russian oil targets. Let's think this through. Does the U.S. attack strategic infrastructure in its wars? Yeah. Oh, yes, we do. Do we care about the price of oil going up at those moments? Okay, again, if you're running a war, you need fuel. You want it at a good price. So the person who needs the fuel, the person fighting the war, that country, wants the price to be low. At the same time, Russia is a petrostate. Ukraine is not. Do you hear me? Russia is a petrostate. It makes its revenues off of the price of oil and gas. Ukraine does not. So what does Russia want? Does it like, would it like a high price for its oil per barrel or a low price? It wants a high price. It can source its own energy at home very smartly. Would that we would think that way, actually. So anyway, I find this really interesting. Recall that during the Cold War, there were many allegations that the Reagan administration colluded with Saudi Arabia to flood the market with oil. We had a lot. They had more at the time. And in doing that, we brought the prices way down, which hurt the revenues of Saudi Arabia at the time and hurt the revenues of U.S. oil and gas. And it put a lot of people out of business, frankly. But it broke the Soviet Union. Okay, that's the theory. That's the theory. We could survive it. Oil and gas is only 8% of our economy. And besides that, We are a importer. We are a consumer of oil and gas. So we like it cheap. Cheap oil is good for you and me. To be perfectly frank, what you and I want in our budget for our checkbook is the cheapest prices possible. But if you go too cheap, American producers go out of business. So this is the problem for us. Russia's thinking the same thing. So I was a little interested. I mean, the prices right this second are not horrible, right? It's totally livable. We have a price right now that Americans can make money on, and the Russians can keep their war alive. I can tell you that American producers, especially in the best sweet spots of America, they don't need the price to be quite as high as we have it now. America, our leadership doesn't think like that. They're not ratcheting it up or ratcheting it down based on what's good for us. In fact, at their every move is to try to destroy U.S. oil and gas, if you haven't noticed. So they don't care about that. I have zero confidence that they're factoring in what is good for U.S. energy as they're making these recommendations. I mean, look, okay, fine. For the current American administration, yes, it makes sense. They don't want high prices between now and November. Because the lower the price, the better you feel. The lower the gas price, the more you're going to credit the president for that, when in fact, the president gets way too much credit for the gasoline price and way too much blame. The truth is, people think that it's, you know, the president sends a signal, and it's a big deal. He is responsible for that. But in this country, there's a lot more that factors into the price of oil and gas, such as Wall Street and its attitude, whether or not it's employing ESG strategies to strangle capital to the oil patch, for example. That would be a big deal. Whether or not the government is prosecuting banks for colluding to divest from the oil patch, because it is a violation of antitrust law. That's a big deal. Is the Department of Justice going after that? No? Okay, that's a problem. So there are ways for sure that the administration can factor in here. But I find it very interesting that the administration would say to Ukraine, because this is a brazen political move. They're basically saying, excuse me, we have an election in a few months. So could you just try to not win this war right now and just hold off on hitting strategic infrastructure of your enemy? Oh, and by the way, we're going to be outfitting them, I'm sure, with energy. They're going to get where's Ukraine going to get their energy from? NATO, right? We're going to storm the beaches of Europe again with LNG this time. It's entirely possible. You want the price to be high or low? You know, these contractor people, you're going to keep an eye on the military-industrial complex. Presidents all the way back to World War II have warned about this. We didn't even have an income tax until World War I. But by World War II, already, we had a whole industry around warfare. It's kind of scary. It incentivizes war. I'd say that's what's going to prolong the war, really, is the profit motive. It's a good thing, but we need to keep it compartmentalized from what the War Department, as it used to be called, is really for. It's for defending the country and our allies. That is all. It's not a jobs program. Going to break. This is the Jackie Daly Show.